accession number 20274, Reel 1.
Ron Newbold, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
In Leicester. Victoria Road, Leicester.
Which year was this?
1916.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Leicester?
Yes, I did, yes.
And how old were you when you left school?
15.
So that would have been in the early 30s?
Yes, that's correct, yes.
Did you get a job?
Yes. Short story about it was that I was not very well educated when I left the council schools, as we call them today, and my mother sent me to a private school when I was 14. But when I got to 15, I heard mother and father arguing one night about the fee and that they couldn't afford it. So I promptly told them that I didn't wish to go to school anymore and I'd get a job, which I did. And I went to work on the sweeping floors, actually, in a hosiery warehouse in Leicester, Woolsey's Limited, the famous Woolsey's. And that was my first job at 15.
What had your father done for a living?
My father worked for the National Cash Register Company, and he was a mechanic. And you remember the tills, they used to ring and the door used to slide open. That was the National Cash Register Company.
And when did you come to join the army?
In 1937.
How did that come about?
Well, I worked at the Woolsey warehouse for just over 5 years. I'd met a young lady there who was an exceptionally good shorthand and telephone typist, and she was earning more money than me, and we wanted to get married, but I said until I could equal her wage and keep her, I wasn't going to get married. At that time, I think I was on about £1.50 a week in today's wages, and she was on about three times that much. I went to join the Leicester Police, and I wasn't very fat at the time. I think I was 6'2" and I weighed 9.5 stone. And again, the education didn't do me much good, I suppose. And the superintendent of the Leicester Police, who actually was an ex-Coldstream Guardsman, said, "Go and join the Guards for 3 years, come back and we'll sort you out." And I then joined the Guards in April 13th, 1937.
Did you sign on for 3 years?
Actually, it was 4 years when I got there. The year services had gone up by 1 year, so I signed on for 4 years.
Where did you do the basic training?
Caterham in Surrey.
Can you tell me about that, please?
Well, it's an old barracks. It's been there many years. I can't actually tell you the years it was built. But you do 23 weeks training down there. And when you leave there, you're a very different man to when you went through those gates. You've got a new outlook on life, both military as well as probably educationally. And I found it quite easy, really. My father was very strict with me, so the sergeant majors didn't have a lot of fear with me. So that was good training, I thought.
How can it give you a new outlook on life?
Well, working in a hosiery factory in Leicester, conditions were very poor, and it seemed to be like sort of four walls round you. But when you've left Leicester, gone across London, down into Caterham in Surrey, and met other people, and you've had training, you've talked about this and that, you realise that there's another world outside the one that you left when you joined the army.
Can you describe the way in which the NCOs treated you at Caterham on the basic training?
Very fairly, I thought. Very fairly. It was at this time when they were trying to cut out any bullying in the armies. So there was no bullying going on. You had to do as you're told and run about and jump about. But apart from that, if you took to the life and did as you was told, I found life was very good. And if you perhaps appreciate that, I said I weighed about 9.5 stone when I joined, and in September of that year, 1937, the time I'd left the depot, Guards Depot, and joined my battalion, and been on a recruit's firing course at Purbright, which is field training as well as firing your rifle, I had gone from 9.5 stone to 15 stone. So the army life with its food must have suited me, I think.
How different was it on the field training from the basic training?
Well, I mean, the basic training was learning how to march, because remember, we are guardsmen. We're going to do public duties, Buckingham Palace and all those sort of things. But field training, you was a soldier, been shown how to kill the enemy. And so you was crawling about on your stomach and all the things that you do if you was in action.
Were you just as happy with Purbright?
Yes.
And what did you become after Purbright?
Well, I joined the battalion at Chelsea Barracks, and I was only a guardsman then. We'd gone from a recruit to a guardsman.
Which battalion was that?
That was the 2nd Battalion of Coldstream Guards. The battalion was not too well with guardsmen, so we're doing a lot of public duties. There's usually three battalions in London sharing the duties. So about every other day you was on public duties of some sort. And also they taught me how to drive military vehicles, which was about 11 weeks course. We went out on Clapham Common and all those places, learn how to drive. But at night we had to do guards on the bank. Bank picket, as they called it, and then that was about every other night, every two nights. So it was quite a busy life in those earlier days. Then in the November, I'd taken a liking to Caterham. I liked it because it was out in the country on Colston Common, and there was an opportunity to go back to the Guards Depot as a trained soldier. This is a man who is in charge of a barrack room of about 20 recruits. And it's your job to, apart from teaching the regimental history and all about the Coldstream Guards, ensure that the chaps have written home to their mothers and they've told them where they are. You have to make sure that they're washed and shaved in the morning. And it was really, so I'm very sorry I felt to some of the chaps who had come from the north, come out of the mines and that. They'd never been in the habit of having a good wash. In the morning, soap seemed to be a thing, something new to them. And that I say, after their 20-odd weeks training, when they left the guards depot as guardsmen, they certainly had a new horizon, because they could see that there was other things outside mines and that sort of thing. And they marched out those gates a lot smarter and a lot more efficient than the day they came in with their bags to join the guards.
So was it in a way like a family upbringing?
Well, yes, I think it was. You learned to have comradeship. We had 20 men thrown together, and when they went out as a body of men.
Any incidents that happened to you when you were acting as a trained soldier to the recruits?
Well, yes, there was one incident which... I thought was always amusing to me, but one of the recruits, he had to go in hospital because he had a skin rash. The khaki uniforms we had in those days were very rough, and he got a skin rash in his crotch, and he had to go in hospital for treatment. And it was part of my job to take his both his army gear and his personal gear, check it, make an inventory, and then hand it into the stores. And during the time I was checking it, I found a bundle of letters tied together, which was not the name of the recruit. And so I didn't say anything. I took the letters on one side, which is probably I shouldn't have done, but he was a nice chap and I liked the way he was going on. When he came out of hospital about 10 days later, I said to him, "I think these letters belong to you, but they're not in your name. Perhaps you'd like to tell me what it's about." And apparently the story was that he'd been serving in the Lancashire Fusiliers, I think it was, and he was actually a lance corporal, but he'd gone absent, taking an army 50-ton weight truck with him, and his rifle and his webbing equipment and run away from the Lancashire Fusiliers. And he joined the guards to give him a way of losing himself, I suppose. And it was this way that every time questions were asked or you told him to stack his equipment up, he was always the first man to do it. And I used to say to him, "How is it you can do it so good compared with other chaps?" He said, "Well, I've got a brother. He's in the army and he showed me." But of course, these letters brought out the truth that he was actually a deserter. So I reported him to the company sergeant major, and he went to the commanding officer later. But because of his good record in his other regiment, and the guards took him, they gave him his previous service back. He only had to pay for the loss of his rifle. Nothing was said about the damage to the truck he'd lost as well. And he finished up that he had 2 more years service in than what I got myself at the time. Unfortunately, he went out to the 2nd Battalion, same battalion myself, and we all went to Dunkirk, where he was one of the chaps that got killed. And I've always felt rather sorry for the way that this ended. But it was just so unusual to find a man that deserted and joined the army again in another name.
Any stories you've got from the public duties in London?
Not
any particular things that happened to you?
Well, the one thing that happened was that as you know, staying outside Buckingham Palace, you have to be at properly attention, and you're not supposed to have the fingers of your hand holding your rifle round the front. You're supposed to grip it between the palm of your hand and your thumb. And on one occasion, the Daily Mirror had been out taking photographs of guardsmen standing outside the palace, and the sentry had actually got his fingers round the front of his rifle. The sergeant major, rather the regimental sergeant major, saw it, and he inquired from the paper as to what time or approximately what time the photograph had been taken and at what point on the palace. And from this information, he got down to the actual guardsman standing on duty. And this guardsman got 8 days CB for standing idle while on sentry. 8 days being a regimental entry on your record.
How did the other guardsmen feel about that?
Well, we didn't, because we were very upset about the Daily Mirror. And it was about the time that we moved from Chelsea down to the Al Bahira barracks in Aldershot. And we boycotted the Daily Mirror. We didn't buy it for about 3 weeks, I think. The paper boy used to come round, could never sell his Daily Mirrors. That was the answer we gave to the Mirror for doing what we thought was a rotten trick.
We sometimes hear these stories about homosexuals supposed to be chasing after guardsmen. Did that happen in those days? Were you warned about it?
Well, no. I say, coming from Leicester, I've been an only boy, perhaps my life was a little bit guardy, and I found London very exciting. But I also found, comparing it with today's aspect of the prostitutes and that sort of thing, that these people, you could speak to them. They were harmless. You could talk to them, and very interesting to talk to them. And they never attacked you or tried to take your money or anything like that. There was one particular fellow we used to meet on Hyde Park when we was out there at night, relaxing with the girls and that sort of thing. He was a little fellow. He actually was a cripple. And about Thursday, when everybody was hard up, we used to go along and say, "Well, let's see if we can find Tina Wad Charlie." This was this queer's name, as we used to say they were. And he was quite happy to talk to these 6-foot guardsmen, been a small man himself. And after, say, 20 minutes or so talking, he said, "Oh, chaps, I've got to move on." And he'd give every one of us sixpence, which in those days entitled us to go and buy a packet of fags, a cake, and probably a cup of tea. And that was why he got his name, Tina Wad Charlie. Wad being the cake.
But do you think he was after sexual company?
No, I don't think so. I think his sexual company was talking to us. He didn't want anything else.
What happened to you next?
Well, I said I then I went to the depot, and the battalion was now. And then the adjutant from the 2nd Battalion came down to see us, which they usually do. Anybody detached from the battalion to anywhere else, they do look you up. And when the adjutant came along and spoke to me, asked me how I was getting on, and they also informed me that the 2nd Battalion were due to go to Egypt in the September of 1939, and would I like to go with them? And I said I would. And within about a fortnight or so, I was sent back to the battalion. And on return to the battalion on orders the following morning, I found my name on the company orders that I had to attend adjutant's orders because I was going to be promoted to a Lance Corporal. And then I had to do 3 weeks cadre course on the square with the regimental sergeant major, learning how to drill people and all those things that a non-commissioned officer should know. And I thought, well, that was it. But then when I got back to my company again, my name was still on orders. This time I had to go to see the adjutant, also the commanding officer. They had decided that they were going to put me as a corporal in the officer's mess, which I rather objected to. But I said, oh, in no way could I look after officers. Their life was not what I'd been used to. So they sent me to back to Purbright, to the officers' mess there, which had been run by an ex-Coldstream sergeant, but he was now a civilian running the mess. And he showed me how to lay the tables and do everything that one has to do when you're in that kind of company. And from then on, I was corporal in the mess, which was quite a intriguing time. I think I was in there about 9 months, and actually till we left the mess to go with the British Expeditionary Force. But the sergeant, the mess sergeant, he went sick on two occasions, which left me in charge of the mess with something like about 25, 30 officers and all their servants, my own mess staff. And I was responsible for the mess from making sure that all the officer servants were up, my own stuff was up every morning, and everything was locked up and put right, the tables were laid. I was more or less like a sergeant major in the mess, looking after everything and keeping everything in order. Plus the fact there was a bar which had to be accounted for. So all this was rather, I was thrown in at the deep end, and I had to learn how to run a bar and look after officers, as well as looking after their food, which I had to order as well. So I really enjoyed it after I got used to everything. And I'll look back on another one of my happier times in the mess, because you got to see as well both sides of an officer. On parade, he was horrible, perhaps shouting and carrying on, but in the mess, they were ordinary, normal people, and they would talk to you with respect and even have a joke with you. So there is always two sides to an officer, I found.
How did you feel when you heard the news of Chamberlain declaring war on Germany?
I don't know. I think because the only radio in the mess, or the only means in the officer's mess, that we had one radio, that was in the officer's lounge. So I managed to be in there when the messages were coming through and actually heard it on the radio. And I think we were all a little bit astounded and said, well, that's it. Now we've got to sort of earn our keep. And it was accepted, really, that that's what our job was, to be a soldier.
And then you said you went to France?
Yes, about 10 days after war declared, we sailed to France. We left Southampton. I can't remember what date it was. But all the battalion sailed on the old paddle steamer, the Maid of the Orleans. I understand that this paddle steamer also took the rest of the brigade, which was the Grenadiers and Hampshires, and we all left from Southampton at different times and finished up in Cherbourg.
And were you in a company and platoon?
Yes. I was. When I left the mess, I was returned to a company, so I now had a section of my own, and I was actually a soldier now, not an officer servant or anything like that.
Do you remember the company, platoon, and sections you were in?
It was in. Well, I don't know. It was a company, Sergeant Major Patterson's platoon, but what number it was, I can't remember that was. And there was sort of. There was about eight sections in the platoon. And each had an NCO of a sergeant or a corporal.
And the company?
It was number one company.
What happened when you got to France?
Oh, we got off the paddle steamer and they were given some light refreshments on the quayside. We were then put in these horrible cattle trucks, which is written in French that... you can get so many animals in it, also so many men. And from there, we spent about 2 days on the train, travelling from Cherbourg to Le Mans. We only travelled when the French lines were clear. We were put into sidings in between times. So it took us a long time to get to Le Mans. From Le Mans, we marched out to a small village, again, which I've forgot the name of, where we were to be stationed for a few weeks. And all this time we were living on army rations, which mostly was tins of corned beef and those very hard army biscuits. But in the September round there, the country lanes, they have apple trees running along the edges and also blackcurrant bushes. So we used to organise ourselves into blackberry or apple pickers. And our company cooks were very good, and from there, we enhanced our food for blackberry and apple pies.
And then?
Then after some time, we were sent up to a town on the Belgian-French border, a town named Bachy, B-A-C-H-Y, which was a station. The railway lines crossed out of France into Belgium, and that was to be our headquarters then. During the winter of 39, which was very cold. The conditions we lived in was very harsh. We only had three blankets each. We did have palliasses, which was supposed to be stuffed with straw, but after a very short time, the straw goes into chaff, so virtually you're laying on the floor. And our jobs there was to actually try to extend the defences from the Maginot Line across Belgium, because Belgium didn't believe in the Maginot Line or anything like that. All they had was a very small tank trench. So we was trying to build reinforcements of earth banks and all that kind of thing. Also, we were trying to build more blockhouses. Which in my own mind, I often wonder if they stood up, because this was freezing weather and the ballast arriving from the pits was so frozen in the trucks, we had to get pneumatic drills to get it out of the truck, then wait for the sun to thaw it out before we mixed it with cement and put it onto the building of the blockhouse and hope that it set something before the frost of the night came up again. This went on right through the Christmas up until about February. One thing I would like to say, though, that the Christmas we spent in Bachy, the loading bay of the station was turned into a big mess room for headquarters and number one company, and our cooks did us marvellous. We had turkey and all the vegetables, Christmas pudding, a bottle of beer, and the sergeants waited on us. And it was really a Christmas that I shall never forget.
How were you getting on with the French population?
Well, it was more or less a hamlet. I think there was, attached to the station, there was about four houses in which we were billeted. And there was across the road there was a large house which had a French family, but we never had little to do with them at all. And about half a mile down the other road, the other way, there was a small hamlet which had a cafe and that sort of thing where we used to go at night for a drink. But really and truly, we never ever spoke to the French people. We never saw any of them. Because it was all farmland, and it was just open land, and we never saw anybody to speak to, really. Occasionally, we used to go into the near town of Douai for recreation, but then that was more or less to concerts set up by the Ensa people and that sort of thing. We never met French people as to have a cup of tea or anything like that with in that fashion.
You were going to say something happened in February.
Well, so from Bashi, we then went into the Maginot Line. Each regiment in the BEF had to take on these duties, which was basically about a mile in front of the French Maginot Line. There were some trenches and dugouts and that sort of thing, which we had to man. It was called the First Defence of the Maginot Line. And that's where we're supposed to be and to help protect the Maginot Line in the first instance from the Germans, who were, there was something like 7 or 8 miles no man's land in front of us before we came to the German Siegfried Line. And from where we used to sit in these trenches, you could look across that no man's land, see the German farmers doing their work on the farm and that sort of thing. But nothing came within our tour there. I say it was still very cold. Our base was in Metz, and after I think it was a month, we had to stay there. We then came back to the area of our previous billets, but it was a place called Pont-a-Marc, which was about 7 or 8 miles further back into France than what we'd been before we'd left for the Maginot Line. From there, when the war was broke out, was it in the May, I think it was, and when we all had to march from there across Belgium to take up the Belgian defences on the German-Belgium frontier. Because the Belgians didn't believe in allowing any British troops in until that particular time. And this was terrible, because the Germans had already advanced through into Belgium. They'd taken over the Belgian guns and turned them around and were using them against us. We were outwitted and outgunned by the mechanised side of the German army. Not heavy armour, but things like motorcycles with sidecars and their Spander guns fixed on the front. And they used to just really run in rings around us. And all we could do was to hold them back as best we could and keep giving each other covering fire. Plus the fact the railheads had all been bombed, so we were getting no rations. We had to live on the land, as they called it, where we used to go around to various towns and find out what we could take out the shops to feed the troops.
Where was it that you moved into contact with the Germans?
I think it was about when we first made contact with the Germans was somewhere about 5 miles short of the large town of Louvain. It was a small village, which again I've lost, can't remember the name, but Louvain was the town. It was just about 5 or 6 miles short of that town.
And did you personally catch sight of the enemy?
No, because I've not said really that during the time that we was in Bashi, I'd been promoted to the post corporal, so I was now attached to headquarter company. My job being to collect the mail from the army post office at various towns, and also to go around the companies delivering the incoming mail, to collect the mail from the other guardsmen and NCOs, etc., and take it back to the post office. But when we went into Belgium and the loss of the railheads and everything, I joined the headquarters quartermaster staff and helped out in general with the supply of food, what we could get from the shops, and make sure it went up the front line. In the headquarter company, there was The butcher was also a slaughterer.